So in 2011, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, USPSTF, that's what that means, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, recommended all children ages 3 to 5 have a vision screen at least once to detect the presence of amblyopia or its risk factors. The AAP endorsed photo screening for preschoolers in a 2012 policy statement. And in 2014, the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research endorsed screening for visual impairment in children 3 to 5, stating that there's good evidence that screening in this age group could lead to early treatment of amblyopia and improve visual outcomes. They felt there wasn't sufficient evidence to recommend for or against screening at an earlier age. So Amy Belial was working on the Improving Health Outcomes for Children grant, and it was, I think, probably 2011 or 2012, and I was working with her on this project, and we were trying to figure out how are we going to screen these wiggly three-year-olds, and what were we going to do to screen kids with developmental disabilities, autism, because they just won't sit still, and they won't do the Snellen chart, and kids who are nonverbal, it's very hard for them. So so I was in my office at the Edmund Irvin Pediatric Center, and we do this program for kids in foster care, and I realized none of these kids coming into care had been screened. And I'm talking the whole age range from a year to up to age 18. And I went to an AAP conference, and they gave a presentation on photo screening. And I thought, I read the data. It sounded interesting. It seemed like something we could do. I convinced the money people to buy this machine because I had also convinced MainCare to pay $10 per screening. So at the time, I think it was Kevin Flanagan, who was the Medicaid medical director, and he said, sure, he would pay for it, $5 to $10 per screening. And we figured, wow, we see 150 kids in the PrEP program a year. So, it would pay for itself in a couple of years. So I was able to get the medical director and everybody else to say, okay, you can buy one of those. And so we did. We screened 180 kids from 2014 through 2015, kids ages 6 months to 15 years, and we identified 54 children that didn't pass the screen. So, you know how these things work. You do the work, you say, okay, well, we've got this. And I said, well, how many of these kids actually got followed up? How many actually needed glasses? What happened to them? So at Maine General, we have these college students from Colby from this program called the Jan Plan program. And I have to do something with them. And I had this, young woman, and she was really energetic. And I said, okay, here's something you can do. Call these people and find out how many actually went to the eye doctor. And so 30 of the 54 actually went to the eye doctor. And how many had an abnormality? 20 had an abnormality. And so 15 of the kids got glasses. One needed surgery. So we thought, well, that's, 65, 66% of the kids that we know didn't pass the screen had an abnormality. So we've continued to see kids and to do the vision screening. So I asked one of our healthcare managers to just look to see how many kids did we not screen in a year. And of the 150 or so kids that we see in a year, there were only 15 kids that we didn't screen. And the reason we didn't screen them was because they were already seeing an eye specialist or they already had glasses. So we screened all of these kids. It wasn't, impossible to do. We built it into our system. We got paid to do it. And we continue to see problems. And I'm just going to, finish with one of the kids that was screened recently is a 7-year-old. He'd never had an eye exam before. And he had funny eye movements, and he didn't pass the vision screen. We sent him to Dr. Nolan at Maine General, and he examined him, and he said, I don't think this kid can see out of that eye, and got an MRI, and he has a hypoplastic left optic nerve. So, for kids who are hard to examine, this kid was really hard to examine. He was really wiggly. but we were able to do the vision screen. And he's one of those kids that might not have been able to do a Snellen chart because he was just so, you know, thorny and reactive. So this is really, it makes a difference. And I would, based on my experience, encourage you all to do it. Now, there are lots of them out there. We have one from one company, and they're here today. But Kennebec Peds has one from another company, and they're happy with theirs. And, you know, you can get one that's in a phone, and we looked at that. We chose not to use that one because they want to keep your data, and Maine General wouldn't let us link to the computer system, and they were concerned about HIPAA issues. But in a private office, that one might be better for you because they'll track the outcomes for you. So with that, that's where we are with vision screening. We have asked Dr. Jeffrey Berman to come and speak today. Dr. Berman is a pediatric ophthalmologist at the Maine Medical Center in Portland. He graduated from Tufts University School of Medicine. I'm also a graduate of that same medical school. I think half of the people of the physicians in Maine may be Tufts graduates. He's an assistant clinical professor at Tufts. Dr. Berman serves a critical role in our state, providing expert diagnostic evaluations and treatment for newborns, infants, and children. You know, I'm also on the Child Death Review Panel. I work closely with Larry Ritchie, who is the only child abuse specialist in Maine. And when you've got a child where you're concerned about abusive head trauma, we desperately need a pediatric ophthalmologist to help us to nail down that diagnosis. So really critically important, and there were only two of these people with this expertise in Maine. Now we have a third, but I think it may be because Bill Lavin is thinking about retiring sometime soon. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Berman and thank you for coming to speak at our conference.
Well, thanks for having me. It's nice to put some faces with names and meet some new names and new faces. And I appreciate being here and being asked to be here. And I don't plan to retire anytime soon. I still have some young kids, so I'll be here for a while. But I agree, this is a really important topic. And it's especially important because it's a preventable, very preventable disease. I hope today you get out of this why it's important to screen kids during childhood before a certain age. I hope you understand some ways to screen accurately. And we'll talk a little bit about new technologies that can help identify risk factors for amblyopia. You know, as Rebecca said, you guys are the heroes. You're on the first line of this condition. When we first got here, it used to be that all kids had a mandatory pre-kindergarten screening. So the only ones that fell through the cracks were kids that were either, they had to be homeschooled and had no primary care. But otherwise, I would say I've been here for 25 years, since 92, and it's pretty rare that I see kids that fall through the cracks where they didn't have a good screening. And I see a lot more kids that were sent who are actually normal than miss as abnormal. And that's really, really good. And it shows what a great community of school nurses and primary care that we have here. And these recommendations, as Steve was saying, were worked out in your task force. They're all part of the Bright Futures periodicity table. And it's really important that they get timely screenings to prevent this condition from occurring. So why is it so important? Why do they lose vision? Well, it's because of something called amblyopia, which you know you all might call lazy eye. There's no such medical term as a lazy eye, but amblyopia comes from the Greek word meaning blunt sight or dull vision. So vision is a weird sense. It's a learned experience. A couple of guys, Hubel and Weasel, in the 50s and up through the 70s, worked this all out in cats. They took cats and they gave visually deprived one eye, and they actually showed that the problem is on a cortical level. So if you take a take a cat and you cover one eye and you open up the eye a year later, the eye looks normal in every way, but the eye is blind because it didn't get any visual stimulation. And that's obviously an extreme example, but there are lots of things in humans that can cause this problem. You know, strabismus is a turned eye, we'll talk a little about different focusing errors, abnormalities in the ocular media, so cataracts and corneal opacities and, you know, droopy eyelids and all kinds of things can cause visual deprivation early in childhood, which can lead to this irreversible condition called amblyopia. And this actually is the most common cause of visual loss in adults ages 20 to 70, untreated amblyopia, and that's worldwide. It's a huge problem where we don't have screenings like this. It's usually unilateral, but it can actually be bilateral. So kids that have really high refractive errors, most commonly high astigmatism, or really high farsightedness, can also develop bilateral refractive amblyopia. So again, it affects about 2 to 4% of the population, probably, you know, 4.5 million kids a year. And the important thing to remember is that these kids are completely asymptomatic most of the time. So they come in, they have no idea that there's a problem. Most of the time, the parents have no idea that there's a problem. So the screening is really, really important because otherwise you can't identify it. And after the age of 10, it's really too late to treat. It's most commonly caused by either strabismus, so a misaligned eye, or what we call anisometropia, so unequal focusing errors. What I always explain to parents is that the eyes don't focus independently. They focus as one unit. So the most common etiology of this is if one eye is really farsighted or hyperopic and the other eye is only normally farsighted or hyperopic, they'll focus hard enough to make the vision clear in the less farsighted eye, leaving the other one blurred all the time. So the message doesn't get back to the brain, and there's a cell dropout in the occipital cortex. There's, you know, these guys, Hubel and Weasel, worked out these things called ocular dominance columns. So if you, you know, section these cats and you looked at a histologic level, you actually see that the cells for one eye didn't develop properly. And it's, there's plasticity to it. So it can be treated early on. You could force those cells to develop. You know, again, ocular media opacities. So congenital cataracts are extremely amblyopiogenic, so they can cause really dense amblyopia, especially in one eye. You know, if you have a kid with a big capillary hemangioma in one lid and it covers the pupil, or if you have a really severe ptosis where the lid is drooping down the below the pupil, that can all cause amblyopia as well. And it, you know, again, why do you want to identify it? Because it could be treated. So with glasses, surgery if necessary. And then penalization. So we penalize the strong eye with a patch or an eye drop to blur the vision in that eye, or filters. There's lots of ways we can do it to force use of the visually weak eye and, again, stimulate the brain to quote, learn how to use that eye. The patching in the community used to be sort of random, but there's been an NIH-funded group of studies. The Pediatric Eye Disease Investigative Group looked at standardizing duration of patching. So for certain levels of vision, we patch 2 hours a day below 20/70, and then worse than that, we patch 6 hours a day. And then, you know, obviously you treat the refractive errors with glasses and you treat the strabismus as necessary. There's been some recent research that shows that even kids in their early teens can be treated, and sometimes even a child that isn't picked up till later can improve, although we prefer to treat them early on. It's much easier early on. I'm just going to go briefly through, you know, what strabismus is. This is a common referral, you know, some child that looks cross-eyed. This child is actually normal, and it's just looks that way because of these little epicanthal folds, so these folds of skin on the inside of the eye. It sort of masks the white on the inside, so it gives the illusion that the eye is crossed. This is something that you're not going to be able to tell, and sometimes I'll bring kids back more than once, especially a one-year-old where they may not be fixating on the target. But, you know, it's important to distinguish between pseudostrabismus and true strabismus. So one thing that I always tell primary care pediatricians and family practitioners is to, you know, make sure you use a good fixation target. You don't want to just use a light to assess vision. Kids don't like light, they'll look away. So, you know, brightly colored toys are really good. And you know, if there is a true misalignment, if you cover one eye, you might see in the case of the optic nerve hypoplasia that kid didn't seem to see with that eye. I mean, it would have been totally obvious. And you know, but if there's a misalignment, if there's good vision in each eye, you'll see some movement if you cover back and forth. That's a cover test. Any shift, you know, any true misalignment, or if you can't tell, means referral. So this is true strabismus. This is congenital, or we call it infantile esotropia now. The onset is usually the first year of life. Typically, it's a large angle, so the eye is really crossed. And sometimes these kids will cross-fixate. Sometimes it looks like a sixth nerve palsy because they may, you know, if you get them to look to the left, you may think that the left eye is not moving out like it should, but actually they're just fixating with the eye that's turned in, so their right eye, and then they'll do the same thing to the other side. Cross-fixation is actually good because it's less likely to produce amblyopia. These kids deserve early surgery to give them a better chance for binocular vision, another learned experience. Binocular vision actually occurs much earlier than monocular vision, so you can address amblyopia, learn it longer than you can address binocular vision. And then sometimes the eye cross is not a surgical problem, it's just because they're highly farsighted and they need glasses. So, you know, this child comes in with a crossed eye and you put them in their, you know, plus four glasses and their eyes are perfectly straight. These are usually intermittent turns, but both can cause amblyopia similarly and just as severely. And then outward turns can do it as well. So you can have intermittent outward deviations of the eye. We call it an intermittent exotropia. You know, this is a child when their eyes are straight, and the same kid when their eyes turned out. Strabismus actually means squint. And if you went to London, they would tell you you had a squint instead of strabismus. It's used interchangeably. These kids will often close one eye in the bright sun, so it's a good question to ask if you're asking a history. And then it's always important at every single visit, I can't stress enough, to check a red reflex, because you definitely don't want to miss a retinoblastoma, even though it's rare, but you know it's the most common intraocular tumor, so or a congenital cataract. So it's important to check a red reflex at each visit. I've had some really good pediatricians pick up anisometropia by the qualitative difference in the red reflex. If a kid's really farsighted in one eye and less in the other eye, it'll actually give a little duller red reflex. So they got sent for a problem with their red reflex, and it turned out they needed glasses. So it's, you know, that was a really good pickup. I've been always super impressed over the last 25 years about the quality of primary care in the state. All right, so early screening, important. You know, again, the pre-K screenings that were traditional here before the 2011 task force were probably too late. It actually becomes less responsive to treatment the older that the kids get. And, you know, permanent visual loss can certainly occur by age 8 and definitely by age 10. You know, again, it's a really common problem. It affects 4 to 5 million people in the United States every year. So, and the kids are completely asymptomatic. So, again, it's important that we pick it up early. So, the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a policy statement in 2016. Instrument-based screening or photo screening is recommended for children 12 months of age and older unless they can reliably perform acuity screening. So clearly the gold standard remains measuring acuity. As I'll talk about in a little bit, these instruments don't actually measure vision. They measure risk factors for the development of amblyopia. So the gold standard, if a child can talk, I mean, I've had two-year-olds who can read down the Snellen letters, but, you know, as Steve was saying, we have a lot of delayed kids, too, that can't do it. But it's a great alternative, and it's great for younger kids before they're verbal enough to participate in the screenings. You know, and there's obvious barriers to the screenings. The kids are wiggly. They don't cooperate. It takes a long time to perform. You know, we're all busy, and patients and families want to get in and out of there. And it's hard to train staff, you know, and to train the nurses to do it correctly. And in the past, it's been, you know, poorly reimbursed. So when you're screening kids, when you're screening their acuity, there are age-dependent thresholds that you look at. So obviously, a young child, a two-year-old, you know, may not test 20/20, and that's not abnormal. And we'll go through some of the thresholds that kids should meet so you know when to refer. You know, in young kids under the age of three, it's important to take a health history. You want to know about strabismus. This is not necessarily a genetic problem, but it is familial, so it's more common to have a family history. You know, oftentimes they'll have a parent or a sibling that will have a similar issue. It's important to you know, have them look back and forth to see how their eyes move, you know, check their ocular motility, and to get a sense of what the alignment is. You know, if there's any concern about strabismus, those children certainly should be referred. You know, again, as I showed you in the other picture, the corneal light reflexes should be in the center of each pupil approximately. And if you can do a quick cover test, you know, even in a young kid, I put my hand on their head and use my thumb to go back and forth. It's amazing that the parents will have no idea, but you try to cover one eye and the kid will really fight to get away from your hand if they don't see well with the eye that's left uncovered. You know, check the pupils. In the case of the optic nerve hypoplasia, there would have been an afferent pupillary defect, so it especially for a severe optic nerve hypoplasia, it'd be pretty obvious that nerve is not working correctly. And then, of course, again, the red reflexes, because you don't want to miss cataracts or retinoblastoma. So once they get a little bit older, they should, between the ages of 3 and 4, they should test around 20/50 in each eye. And we'll go over some of the testing methods. You should standardize the distance. It should be at 10 feet. Most of these charts are calibrated that you're going to use in your office at 10 feet. They convert it into a 20 number, but the testing distance is usually 10 feet. And you always have to make sure that when you're training your nurses or the nurses in the room when you're doing it, you know, I always find that everybody's looking at the chart and no one's looking at the kids. So you're, you know, everyone's looking there and you think you're testing the left eye and they're, you know, the kid's looking with the right eye because no one's looking at the child. So it's important that the eye is covered appropriately to really tell what the vision is. You know, usually if you can use a patch, that's even better. So, you know, an adhesive patch that you can just put on the skin, because then you know the child's not peaking. These are the two recommended eye charts that we use, either the Lee symbols or the HOTV letters. The HOTV is really good. There's no right, left orientation for any of the letters. They're the same both ways. You'll notice that they're the same number of optotypes across all the way down the chart. So there's, you know, 5 optotypes all the way down the chart. And they're all similar thickness, and there's nothing filled in. They all have similar appearance. These are not so good. You know, you'll notice that there's different thicknesses. They're just easier to guess at. So these are not great symbol charts. There's also, you know, less up here and more down here. And the tumbling E's aren't great either. They take a lot of coordination. You know, kids just don't do well with them. So by 4 to up to 5, they should be a little bit better. They should be 20/40. One thing that I do in my office, and you know, and you can do in your office, is most of these charts come with matching cards. So even if the kid can't say HOTV, they can point to them. So you can have somebody point to the letter up on the chart, and they can point on the card, and they can match it. So it takes some of the verbal skills out of it. And then once you're 5, you really should be around 20/30 in each eye. We talk about Snellen acuity because that was the original eye chart, but remember in the Snellen chart that the big E is on top, there's only one letter, and then there's more as you go down. So these Sloan letters, again, have the same number of characters all the way up and down. So if you can get these for your office, they're probably preferred for screening, or in the schools, they're better. And the testing should be repeated, you know, every year if possible, but, you know, certainly at least every 1 to 2 years. APOS, the American Association for Pediatric Ophthalmology and Strabismus, of which I'm a member but have no financial interest, does sell these screening kits that come with, occluder patches and glasses and paddles and, measuring cords so you can measure off the distance, and also the Sloan letters, and then you can get a choice of the Lee symbols or the HOTV, and DVDs and maybe a set of knives. I don't know what it comes with. But they're a good organization, and they do try to help kids. So there's two ways to do this. You can go use threshold, so go down to a certain level, or just check a critical level. If you're doing mass screenings of the exact same age, you can use actually the critical level of vision, which we'll go over. For threshold screening, this is how we traditionally think about testing acuity. You know, you go down the line and see how far you can go. You can either stop at a certain threshold. So, you know, if you're testing a five-year-old, you know, you can stop at 20/30. But going down is even better, and there should be referral for two or more lines difference between the two eyes. So if a five-year-old tests, if either eye tests worse than 20/30, or if there's two or more line difference between the two eyes, they should be referred. In fact, you know, in my office, usually we don't treat amblyopia if it's just one line difference. So if you get notes from me, sometimes I may opt not to patch if it's, you know, one eye's 20/40 and one eye's 20/30. It usually has to be two or more lines difference. But if you're not sure, you know, these are obviously not emergencies. You know, you don't want a year, but you might retest in 6 months if there's a small difference. Especially for mass screening, so the nurses, if you have a group of kindergartners that you're screening, you can just do a critical line screening. So you can go down the chart, and usually what we'll do is we'll cover, you know, if you're doing a mass screening, you can cover these two. Just let's practice, you know, you make sure the kid knows their letters, so you can start with the top, and then, you know, right eye would do this line, and the left eye would do this line, and if they pass, fine, and if they don't, you can test further or just refer. But critical line screening is faster, and it's good for mass screenings of the same age. You know, again, don't allow peeking. You know, I've had little siblings up in the front, you know, giving the it's E, you know, no help, please. The grandmothers, you know, they like to help, but try to avoid any help. Yeah, especially the new millennial parents, they want their kids to do really well on the test. Yeah. All right. I mean, that's the most important thing because it identifies amblyopia, but there's other screening kits you can get from APOS, including color vision tests and stereo acuity. You know, you could have good vision in each eye but have strabismus and not have normal stereo acuity. And then, you know, near cards are not quite as important because they don't necessarily measure amblyopia. So you could have 20/50 vision in one eye, 20/20 in the other eye. But with a near card, your vision in the amblyopic eye could actually be close to 20/20 just because it's a little closer and it's bigger. The kids can pick it out quicker, more easily. And it's the age of computers, and they do make all kinds of computerized eye charts if you'd prefer. You know, you could get them, these online or on tablets or smartphones. But, you know, the important thing to remember, these aren't necessarily standardized, so the testing distances are not standardized, so the accuracy is not quite as good as having a mounted wall chart or something where you know it's 10 feet. The distance does make a big difference. You know, again, you can get these vision charts for the iPad, but you'd have to mount it at a testing distance where you know exactly the distance that you're testing from, or else it's inaccurate. And they make Windows versions of this as well. There's a nonprofit group that will get you these, and I think they're free. Yeah, which is always good, free. So with amblyopia, there's something called a crowding effect. It's easier to see the end letters on either side. So the reason we use a row of five letters instead of just isolating them. You can have an amblyopic eye that is 20, you know, 60 or 20/70, and if you isolate the letters, they might test as good as well as 20/30. So the reason is this crowding effect. So they put these bars around the letters, and it reduces the crowding effect. There's lots of interesting properties with amblyopia, how people describe their vision. If anyone has amblyopia in the room, you know, people sometimes will describe it as, you know, if you're looking out at a blacktop road on a hot day, you see those little convection currents coming off of it, so it's a little bit smoky. And again, if you're testing them, you'll see that they may get the first letter and the last letter, but miss the middle letter. This is the other important thing. So they can miss like a couple of letters on the line, but they shouldn't miss three or more letters on the line when you're testing them. And you do get paid for these, so you can bill for it in your offices, both the acuity screenings and, as I'll point out, the instrument-based screenings as well. So we like to term these instrument-based vision screening devices now, rather than photo screening. Originally, it was called a photo screening because you actually took a Polaroid picture and of the red reflex, so it was literally a photo screening. It's important to remember that these don't replace visual acuity screening charts, but they're very helpful in pre-verbal kids or uncooperative kids when they're a little bit older. So again, the original photo screening by MTI actually took two Polaroids of the red reflex, and then there was someone who was trained in reading these things, and they looked at the size and the shape of the red reflex crescent, and they were able to determine if there was a high astigmatism or high hyperopia or high myopia. So originally they were called photo screenings. But again, now we call them instrument-based screenings, and both the pediatrics and the American Academy of Pediatrics and APOS recommends instrument-based screenings for children aged 1 to 3. It's a great, and it's also, again, it's an acceptable alternative for kids older between 3 and 5, but the gold standard remains acuity screening. You know, obviously, I don't want to hammer this to death, but it's, you know, unless the child's not able to do the acuity screening, that should be the way you go. So the eye chart tests 20-something, 20-whatever. Again, you know, it's 10 feet, but they convert it to a 20-feet number. The vision screening devices don't test vision directly. They assess for risk factors. They all somehow capture a photographic image of the eye's red reflex or use some other measurement to estimate the refractive error, which is the prescription of the eye. So the refractive error is made up of the shape of the cornea, which is the front dome over the eye, and the length of the eye. So if your cornea is steep or your eye is long, you're myopic or nearsighted. If the cornea is relatively flat or the eye is short, you're hyperopic or farsighted. If it's oval shape or football shape, I tell parents, you have astigmatism. And there's levels that are acceptable. So most children are a little bit farsighted, a little bit hyperopic. They don't need reading glasses unless they're highly hyperopic. You could be mildly myopic or mildly nearsighted. You don't necessarily need glasses in a young child, you know, especially a two-year-old. You know, their world is right here. So if they're a minus one, it's not a big deal. And, you know, for astigmatic refractive errors, it's age dependent. So how much astigmatism there is or what difference between the two eyes there is will determine whether glasses are indicated. But these screening devices give you a range of what it is, and they help you determine when to refer. They also, a lot of these will test for strabismus as well, and they'll also test the red reflex for you. This is the plus optics, and here's a bunch of common ones that are in common use today. The Welch Allyn SureSight, the eye screen, the Welch Allyn Spot, and the Plus Optics. They all are pretty good. They have something to engage the child while you're taking their red reflex. They all have some form of digital readout to tell you whether if there's a problem or if you should refer them. Just to go through some quickly, the Welch Allyn Spot is good. It it supports the AAP screening guidelines for early detection of amblyopia. Pretty easy to use, you know, good battery. They're highly sensitive. These tests all should be highly sensitive. You should lose specificity to sensitivity. So, you know, you'd rather obviously refer normal kids than miss abnormal kids. They're not cheap, but they're useful. Uh-oh, stuck. Oh, there you go. The eye screen, another one, provides a fast, easy, and portable pediatric vision screening solution. This one, I think, is you have to send it to a trainer, and they read it, and then they send you back a report. It's pretty quick, but they keep all the information. It's a little less expensive, but they charge you per screen, I believe. Plus Optics, really good. They actually created the world's first immediate read vision screener and the first auto refractor. Very sensitive, and high specificity. They have a range in cost similar to the Welch Allyn one, and they also screen for refractive errors, strabismus, and anisocoria as well, unequal pupil sizes. This one comes with a good warranty, apparently. All right, then there's a whole bunch of other vision screening devices that you're probably not going to get. There's a portable VEP that you can actually do in your office. VEPs are, they're kind of like EEGs for the eye. They test the signal between the eyes and the occipital cortex. I don't know if it's going to be very useful for a screening. There's some automated computerized software that you can use where they actually test. The kids don't really know that their vision is being tested, and it comes out with a number. It's called the iSpy. Before they know it, you get a vision screen. But again, it's hard to know how close they are to the screen, and they're not quite as good. So, and then there's newer technology that uses retinal birefringence, and it tests for amblyopia, looking for something called a microstrabismus or a micro squint, where if amblyopic eyes tend to have abnormal fixation, this is probably more than you want to know about amblyopia, but they have something called a microsuppressing scotoma, so your brain will turn off the vision in that eye, and somehow this can tell exactly what part of the fovea that the eye is fixating with, so it identifies small angle strabismus for you. But again, the big ones are the first slide I showed you. And then there's even an app for it that you can get, of course there is. Okay. So, when to photo screen, I wouldn't bother before 1 year of age. That's most important before age one is to look at the red reflex, to look for evidence of strabismus. Make sure you're covering one eye and then the other, and make sure that they seem to be able to see well with each eye. Look for nystagmus, look for obvious evidence of poor vision. But if you pick up a refractive error in an 8-month-old and send them, unless it's a huge refractive error, which is pretty rare, I'm probably not going to prescribe glasses. I'm probably going to bring the child back in 6 months and check them again. It's important to remember that the eye grows a lot in the first year or 18 months of life. So most kids early on are highly hyperopic, but 6 months later they might be moderately hyperopic. It'll change a lot. The cornea changes shape. The eye changes shape. The eye grows. So before one, it is really not, I don't think, as important. The other thing is the false positive rate is pretty high in really young kids. But it's really useful between, 1 year or 18 months and age 3. And if you can get one of these for your office, my advice would be to try them out and see which one you and your staff like to use the best, and see which one you find the easiest. That's what most practices do. And the companies usually let you try them for a while and see if you like them. And just remember that if a child's verbal enough to check their vision, that's the best way to go. Check their acuity. This is the United States Preventive Service Task Force, which has shown that photo screening is an appropriate method for vision screening age 3 to 5. So it's not experimental. It's a real thing, and it's very good. And in fact, there's been some recent studies that maybe it's better. I'm not convinced yet. I still think that acuity screening is the best way to go. Again, you know, my experience in the state has been that you guys do a great job, and it is really rare. I mean, I see, you know, like 6,000 patients a year, and it's very rare that I'll see someone fall through the cracks where they get screened as normal and they're actually abnormal. So I think you all do a great job. So when you're thinking about when to refer, you know, again, the age is important. So the threshold for referring somebody young should be higher than somebody a little bit older. And I don't mind seeing normal kids. I'd rather see 100 normal kids than miss one abnormal kid. So, you know, I get pediatricians ask me, I feel bad about the referral. I mean, never feel bad. I'm happy to have all the referrals. And you know, again, I'm happy to just reassure a parent that there's no problem. And, you know, screen again next year, come back if there's a problem. So in your handout, again, this is maybe beyond the scope a little bit, but it'll give you the target risk factors for the difference in the focusing errors by age. So again, younger children, there has to be a bigger refractive error or a bigger difference between the two eyes for it to cause a problem. The two biggest culprits for refractive or anisometropic amblyopia are asymmetric astigmatism and asymmetric hyperopia. It's rare for asymmetric myopia to do it. So you have to have really more than 3 diopters difference between the two eyes for myopia to do it. For hyperopia in a 5-year-old or someone greater than 4, more than a diopter and a half of difference of astigmatism, or more than 3 diopters of hyperopia in both eyes. I mean, those kids should probably be referred. And then, of course, any medial opacity. So, you know, even small cataracts can be pretty amblyopogenic. So refer those as well. The other thing I'll mention about strabismus, which sometimes is a common misconception, the size of the turn doesn't predict the risk of amblyopia. So you can have an eye right into the nose and have 20/20 vision in each eye as long as you cross fixate, you know, go back and forth. But you can have a micro squint or just a small, barely perceptible esotropia. You can't tell at all, and that can cause 20/200 vision. So the size really has no, of the deviation, makes no difference as far as whether it's going to cause amblyopia or not. And again, they talk about the refractive risk factor target numbers on the table, and what the screening instruments should be set out are a little bit different. So, just be careful of that. And, you know, you're going to get some false positive readings because kids accommodate a lot. They may make themselves look more nearsighted than they really are or less farsighted than they really are. And all these device manufacturers have specific guidelines to help you. And again, I encourage you to try them out. And you get paid for this as well. There's a different reimbursement code. So they're different codes. That's the point of the slides. In the back of the handout, there's some links that you can use if you want to check out some of these things that we spoke about. And there's a vision screening recommendation that would be good to have, you know, for your nurses and in your exam rooms. It'll help you to know when to refer. So I do think you guys are the first line of defense, and I've been really super impressed over since 1992 about the job that you do, and I think that Maine children really have a good, they have really good health care here. So I've been really, really happy since I moved here, and I think everyone in this room does a fabulous job. So I'm happy to entertain any questions. Thanks for asking me to speak.